This podcast is powered by The Plug.
Who's gonna get it out? It ain't even mine to hold, man. Tech ready. Tech that.
All we got is our word. Hello, this is Marisol Solar Therilocker, psychotherapist and consultant. And this is the Resilience and Resistance Podcast, a podcast about successful Black, Indigenous women of color who have overcome trauma and become resilient.
Hi, Nicole.
Hello, Marisol. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being a guest on this podcast. I'm really excited to have you on.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. It's been a couple of years since we've been in the same room together.
A couple of years. Oh, my gosh. I was actually trying to think back. I was like, when was that?
Yeah.
So I went back.
Well, I graduated in 2013.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was before that.
Yeah. Because you were at the clinic. So that would have been your last year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was 2013.
So, yeah.
So, oh my gosh. More than 7 years? Is that 8 years?
Well, I don't know. With these COVID times, you know, my memory is like, well, it either happened yesterday or 15 years ago. I'm not sure.
I know. I feel like every time I think about my work and, you know, how long I've been doing things, it's pretty humbling.
Yeah.
I'm young in my soul. I'm young in spirit. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was so excited to have you and for so many different reasons. And I think that, you know, not only just because, you know, having contact with you, I think that you are obviously a very delightful human being. But, you know, I think that you have a lot to share in terms of, I think just what right before our interview, you were talking about lots of different intersections. One of those being your profession, right? Having a master's in counseling and then, you know, being a minister. Is that your proper title?
I'm ordained in the Ministry of Word and Sacrament in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Right.
So my official title is the Reverend Nicole.
Ah,
but we frequently go by Pastor Nicole.
Pastor, right.
Yeah, so.
Little known fact about me, I actually did go to seminary.
I
did go to seminary. That's a conversation we could have offline, but it makes me feel like I'm so far removed from that, so many years away. I don't know my proper titles anymore, Nicole. It makes me feel disconnected. But I would love for you first and foremost to introduce yourself. You know, again, the work that you do, who you are, how you identify, a little bit about maybe where you come from, where you grew up, and anything you think would be important for our audience to know.
Well, I actually came from and grew up in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh.
I haven't gotten very far. I now live in Louisville, so I made it up the hill, so to speak. But I spent all my formative years in Boulder, elementary through CU Denver, where I got my bachelor's in political science in 1982.
Oh,
never got that far away. I had always intended to be an attorney, then I did an internship at a law office and hated it just passionately. And you know, I had worked since I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And then in high school, I got a job with JCPenney selling suits. And so I ended up staying in retail sales until about from the time I was about, 16, 17 till my mid 30s. And then in my mid 30s, I had a crisis and ended up deciding I needed to be a police officer, but instead I got hired by the Colorado Department of Corrections. So I ended up 5 years working as an officer and got promoted to sergeant. Nobody likes being in prison, so I got out and worked 11 years as a parole officer. And when I met you, I had just left my position as a parole officer in order to pursue a master's of divinity because I had worked for about 2.5 years full-time as a PO, and then went to CU Denver part-time to earn my master's in counseling. So I was getting to the point where I didn't want to work the streets anymore. It was getting more dangerous, and it was time for me to move on. So that's why I wanted to be a therapist. And then I had been working in the church, in the Lutheran church, for many years, and I discerned a call to ministry. So when I met you, I was really freaking out because I thought I had taken on too much. So I left my job at the state, finished my master's in counseling, continued on with my seminary degree. And so I went into private practice. I was in private practice in Longmont, working primarily with the transgender community. Mm-hmm. I identify as a transgender Latina. When I was, you know, started working in parole and corrections, I identified as male. And I part of the big reason why I took the job was to really prove to myself and the world I was the man I thought I was. It didn't work.
Yeah.
It failed miserably.
Yeah.
And I basically ended up being angry and drunk most of the time. And I decided I had to do something, went back into therapy and discovered who I truly was.
Wow.
And my life completely changed
mm-hmm.
on every level.
Mm-hmm.
Every level.
Yeah.
So now I ended up being ordained as a Lutheran pastor in November of 2019. Mm-hmm. Have my own church in Boulder called Westview. And we were just starting to really take off. And this whole freaking pandemic thing happened and closed down.
Yep.
So now I'm like we do a Twitch TV live feed every Sunday morning, and I do a prayer service on Wednesday evenings. So I'm kind of like a televangelist these days.
That's a career path you didn't think you would go down.
Ever, never. But I'm not going to start searching for my mansion and stuff like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
No. So I still work part-time as a therapist with a group called the Umbrella Collective, and we work primarily with the LGBTQ+ community, and we take Medicaid. I made a commitment to serve the underserved. So when I found the Umbrella Collective, and I knew the clinical director, Lee Brookins, really well, and I came on board. And so now I only have about 4 clients that I see per week, and mm-hmm. then I work as a clinical supervisor. So I have 3 brilliant young people that I work with as a supervisor. They're my legacy.
I've gotten
2 people that I've worked with have gotten their LPCs, so I'm really thrilled about that.
Mm.
So trying to, you know, make sure that people are competent in working with the trans and non-binary community.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes my experience helps, and sometimes my experience gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also, as you know, a Latina, my family has been in the United States before it was the United States. My family traced its way back to the conquistadores that settled Taos, New Mexico in the mid 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my mama is adamant, don't ever call mama Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
She's Spanish.
Spanish.
She's yes. Spanish, and her grandfather was Italian.
Mm-hmm.
The latest immigrants to arrive in my family was my great-grandfather, Giovanni Lorenzi, who arrived in 1872 from northern Italy.
Wow.
Somehow ended in a little town called Walsenburg, Colorado, in southern Colorado, and married Eduvigen Gonzalez.
Wow.
And the Gonzalez's, you know, trace all the way back to the conquistadores. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on the other side, the Garcias. They all kind of, if you go back far enough, they're all related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Right. This is such an interesting part of our regional history, right? I think that it's so different in different parts of the United States. And I think that I'm not originally from Colorado, and coming here, I've learned a lot about, you know, the history and, you know, the generational history and how people identify and what that means. And it's been a really interesting part of my understanding of this part of the country and how that plays into identity.
I did a little online workshop for one of my friends who's up in North Dakota. And so they wanted to do something on different aspects of racism and race. And I did a 90-minute talk on we're not all the same
mm-hmm.
Latinx community, because my family, you know, came from Colorado. We trace back to the conquistadores. And most people think that everybody is from Mexico,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. you know, in this part of the country. But, you know, there are people from El Salvador, Nicaragua,
mm-hmm.
You know, Central America, South America. I listened to your podcast. I believe you're from, you're one of the podcasts where you talked, where you turned over the microphone.
Yeah,
were
yeah,
you from
yeah.
Colombia.
Yeah, my dad's Colombian and my mom is Mexican American. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we all have different customs and we all have different foods and all have different music. And, you know, I went to a conference with a Episcopal Latino group. Mm-hmm. And we met in North Carolina and I didn't understand. My Spanish isn't that good. But I could hardly understand everything because almost everybody was Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Puerto Ricans are blah, 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 blah. I'm like, what did you say? Write it down for me. The Puerto Ricans are just like, it's a time limit. You got to get it out and you got to get moving on. And then the Cubans always sound like they're kind of mad.
That's true. Right.
And then when I say something, they're like, oh my God, are you talking so slow? Yeah. And then, you know, my grandparents, all from Southern Colorado, they have influences of a lot of the native tribes that spoke. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought that my great grandmother was Apache mm-hmm. for a long, long time because she mm-hmm. spoke a dialect that was spoken on the reservations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's because they all grew up around there and they had a lot of interaction with the native population. So the Spanish they spoke had a lot of Apache phrases in it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when I tried taking Spanish in school, which they taught Castilian, yeah. I would write down what grandma would say and I would fail.
Yeah.
Then I'd go over to grandma's house and talk to her like they taught me in school and she'd smack me in the back of the head. And I was like, what are you doing? What are you trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a deep, deep thing, just in terms of language and dialect and region and, you know, all the ways that these things come together and intersect is such a, it's a whole thing right now that I have been thinking through in terms of like, you know, I think even now, as you're talking about like the Latinx community and how we are just the use of the word, right? Just saying Latinx, Latine. Has been a huge transition, and I think one that has been met with a lot of resistance. And so, you know, Latinidad is so interesting and complex, and like you're saying, and there's, I'm gonna do a whole series on that. I've already said that multiple times in this podcast, but it's so I think important because I think that currently. I think the way that we're understanding it and the way that we're thinking about it is important because I think it's definitely going to be transformative in terms of not only our political position, but also how we start to really fight anti-Blackness in our communities and in this country and then around the world. So, but that's a whole other conversation that we all need to have.
Yeah. And, you know, if you go to the Cubans and Puerto Ricans, there are a lot of Afro Latinx people because the ships stopped in the Caribbean.
Right.
And, you know, and you go down to South America and, you know, the ships stopped in South America. It's mm-hmm. not just the United States.
Right. Right.
So,
yeah. So I have so many questions now just from your introduction.
Go ahead.
I know. Here we go.
No, I have to say, be careful. I'm a pastor. You could get a 3-minute response or a 45-minute sermon.
No, that is perfect. This is exactly what I want. I think what's so interesting to me, and I was just trying to kind of create the timeline of everything that you've done. I mean, which is quite remarkable, to be honest, Nicole. I feel like I've been in private practice for 17 years, and I feel like, wow, I've really done a lot in this. And you have shifted careers so many times and really, I think, challenged your own, I guess, the lens by which you see yourself in terms of different positions, different capacities that are so, you know, divergent. But I'm curious in terms of your process, in terms of when you talk about having your own internal crisis, and it seems like that happened before you started your degree in counseling. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And was the impetus for you entering therapy? I want to talk more about that in terms of how culturally for you the process of coming to the understanding of the your own identity, right, in conflict and mm-hmm. actually making the choice to go to therapy. Love to know like your process around that and how that was and you know, what maybe if there were any types of barriers that you felt were in the way of making that happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, first you have to understand I was born the oldest son in a very Roman Catholic family. Mm-hmm. And then my father was killed in a car accident when I was two.
Oh, wow.
Which elevated my status in the family even higher.
Right.
And so I never sat at the kids' table. I always sat next to grandpa. I was always given at least is my impression. I don't know if my mother or sisters would agree, but I always felt like I was always pushed forward first, mm-hmm. and give it a preferential treatment in the family. And then my stepfather, my mother remarried when I was five. And it just seems that I was always trying to live up to my father. Because my stepfather, my mother's family just disliked my stepfather intensely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always felt like I was competing with my dead father, who was, you know, a Marine who fought in Korea, 1st Marine Division. And, you know, when somebody died, he went into the Marines because he was put in front of the judge and said, you either go into the service or you go to jail. But after he died, he became a saint. And mm-hmm. that's what I felt like I competed with. And we always went to Mass. I remember, you know, we're just starting this period of Lent. I remember Lent of being very dark, praying all the time. Good Friday service was 3 hours long, mm-hmm. you know, being just such a good little Catholic boy. And I fell in love with church. Absolutely loved church when I was 18. And then when I was, you know, really into church in the 70s and into the 80s, it was really when Vatican II had just really started moving across the country. So, you know, all the organs and pianos were shuttered and guitar masses were all the rage. Mm-hmm. And I played guitar. So I played in two or three different, you know, little guitar choirs, and it was nothing for me to go to church two or three times in a weekend. If there were a wedding or a quinceañera, I would be there 5 days a week. And, you know, I was on church council, I was on committees, I went to retreats. And at 18, I remember sitting with Father Terry saying, you know, I want to become a priest, and was about ready to do it when Mama and Grandma said, no, you're the oldest son, you're to get married, you're to have kids, you're to carry the family name.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I ended up going to CU for college. Mm-hmm. None of my other cousins, male cousins, were ever told they were going to college. They all went into the military, every one of them. But I went to CU because I was set aside. I was supposed to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And I just put a lot of pressure on me.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was a senior, I'd started drinking fairly heavily. Because I just had no idea how I could live into it.
Yeah.
And then when I decided not to go to law school, I thought, well, I'll go to a grad school and get a degree, a master's degree in American government, and write, you know, the great expose on everything. But I ended up leaving because I had no direction any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up leaving the church because I really had come to terms with the fact, when I went to CU Boulder, it had a fledgling Chicano studies program.
Yeah.
And I was automatically put into the United Mexican American Student Association.
Mm-hmm.
So I took all the Chicano studies classes. All the professors I had were the ones who had protested back, you know, 5-7 years earlier. They all had their master's degrees and working on their PhDs. And that's when I really realized and recognized how the church had colonized us.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, with the conquistadores came the priests, and you became Catholic or you died. And if you became Catholic, you died anyway. And so I really had it put in my face where I wasn't Catholic out of faith. I was Catholic out of requirement and necessity. And it caused a really huge conflict within myself. And on the other side, I was trying to figure out my sexuality. There was no way I could be gay. I was a good Catholic boy, and I had always had a girlfriend to show off. but I never had anything serious. And, you know, I'd been, you know, attracted to men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would act on it when I was drunk, but, you know, that wasn't really real because I was drunk.
Right.
So it didn't count.
It didn't count.
Mm-hmm. Then I would pray to God to fix me, to make me the man I was supposed to be. And when God didn't fix me, I'm like, I'm done. One, the church totally let me down, and God has totally let me down, so forget it. I'm done with it. Mm-hmm. So I turned my back on God and religion and walked away for 20 years. And then I got married in the Catholic Church because I found a woman who we fell in love and decided to get married, and I figured she would fix me and everything would change. And not long after we got married, I heard rumors in the family that people thought, some of the members of my family were surprised I got married because they thought I was gay. Because they would see me in the bars with guys all the time. And mm-hmm. I was in the bars with guys all the time. I was in the bars with girls all the time. I was in the bars with everybody. I've always been queer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'm married now. I can't let that happen. Mm-hmm. So what's the best way to do it? One of my best friends ended up being a police officer. And so I ended up going to the police academy, getting my police officer certification, and mm-hmm. then got it hired by the Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. That's how I ended up in prison.
Yep.
I was trying to prove so hard to myself mm-hmm. and everybody else. I was the man of the family.
Right.
Just ended up miserable.
Yeah.
And so one day, you know, wife and I had grown apart. You know, I was an angry, bitter, drunk person, so we rarely saw each other. And working, you know, in a prison, my work schedule was always very different from hers. So I ended up living on one side of the house. She lived on the other side of the house. We met in the dining room one day, and she said, I want a divorce. I'm like, sure. Mm-hmm. I have no problem. Yeah. She worked for lawyers, 90 days, $90. We were divorced. I bought another house, moved out. 2 weeks later, I'm sitting in my living room, half drunk, trying to decide if I'm going to shoot myself under the chin or in the temple.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's when I kind of had my come to Jesus moment. Mm-hmm. I'm just sitting there. And it's like, I know I can't kill myself.
Yeah.
So what do I do? You better step it up this time. If I come back, you better step it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then within a couple of days, I was sitting at my computer at work, and a little thing came up that said, from the state employee assistance program, if you're depressed, if you're suicidal, if you're abusing substances, give us a call, you get free therapy. Mm. I'm like, crap, you're quick. And before I knew it, that week I was in therapy. And after about three sessions with that person, because you only got six sessions, she's like, you need some long-term care. I'm like, well, thanks very much. So I ended up going through my insurance and found a therapist who was just brilliant. Mm. And she helped me get sober again. I got onto some antidepressants and just opened up to her that my entire life I had always loved wearing women's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up getting referred to the Gender Identity Center of Colorado, continuing therapy to dig deeply into who I was and how I identified.
Yeah.
And then I went to a conference where I met, because, you know, I thought I was the only, you know, I had no idea what I was. I thought I was a cross-dresser.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to this conference and found like 250 people there, just like me.
Yeah.
I was like, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And one of the friends that I made that was in about the same place in their transition that I was, and she was a detective in a police department. So we had a lot in common. We used to hang out together. And I told her, you know what? I'm having a reemergence of my faith. I don't know what it looks like, but I know I can't go back to the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because I was trans, but I was divorced.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
And so I'm like, I don't know what to do. And she said, I found this church in downtown Denver. It's a Lutheran church. In downtown Denver. And I'm like, oh no. And she's like, well, why not? Well, it's founded by the heretical excommunicated Catholic priest, Martin Luther. Uh-huh. Oh, it's, you know, he was Satan.
Uh-huh.
That's what I grew up learning. Like all the Protestants were just, you know, heretical. But after the third time she asked me, I'm like, well, maybe the Holy Spirit's trying to tell me something. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going, and I was at the point in my transition where I was presenting and living as Nicole outside of work. And so I put on my nicest outfit, and, you know, I thought I put on makeup like a 12-year-old girl who got into her mother's makeup. But I walked in fully expecting people to, you know, point and stare at the man in a dress. But they were lovely. They welcomed me. They hugged me. They asked me if I like service, and they asked me back. Wow. And, you know, that was probably in April of 2003. By October 2003, I became a Lutheran. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went through the catechumen classes, basically the classes, basic Lutheran indoctrination. Mm-hmm. And Martin Luther answered all the questions and issues I had with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The hierarchy was wrong. The priesthood was wrong. The infallibility of the pontiff was wrong. He answered all the questions in a way that I could really buy into it, understand, and love. Mm-hmm. So I started working with the Lutheran Church in 2003 and just fell in love with it. Mm. And then I realized I had become a parole officer to prove I was a man. It didn't work. Yeah. And it was time to find, you know, Nicole's job.
Yeah.
So I ended up moving into administrative position, found the counseling program at CU Denver, and started going to school.
Wow.
So I did that for 3 years. Yeah. Worked full time and went to school part time.
Yeah. And how did that progression into the Lutheran Church impact your family? What was their response?
Well, I think it was easier for Mama to accept me as her daughter than it was for her to accept me as a Lutheran.
That's why I asked the question first.
until one, I think it was an Easter that I convinced her to go to church, because I went to church in downtown Denver, St. Paul Lutheran at 16 and Grant. Mm-hmm. And Pastor Kevin at the time really liked high church, mm-hmm. which made it very, very simpler, mm-hmm. very, very similar to a Catholic mass. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I took Mama, I think my Aunt Kathy, to church with me on Easter morning. And, mm-hmm. you know, Easter morning, they just pulled out all the stops, all the flowers, the brass is out and all the, and as we were leaving, she's like, oh my gosh, that was just like real church.
Aww. I'm
like, yes, Mama, it is. All right. I can let you be a Lutheran.
Oh, yeah.
And so now, you know, for my ordination, I was ordained here in Louisville, mm-hmm. and my mother and my two sisters put my stole around my neck, mm-hmm. which was Aww. So, so important to me. So Mama really loves the fact that I go to church, mm-hmm. and now mm-hmm. that I'm a pastor.
Yeah.
She's very, very proud of it. Even though I'm not Catholic, she's okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So second question to that is, what was that like for you to start to help your family understand your transition and your mom's acceptance of that? What was that process like?
You know, I came out first to my sisters, and there were a lot of tears and a lot of questions. And, you know, my sister, Star, actually went and sat and talked with my therapist for a session, mm. just to make sure that my therapist wasn't a quack and trying to talk me into something. Mm. And, you know, I still offer that to clients. You know, like if you have family or spouses, and I've talked to a few people just so they know that I'm not trying to sell them something. Mm-hmm. So my sisters were kind of on board. I was just terrified to say anything to my mother. But mm-hmm. one day I was at the house doing something, and keep in mind that the previous 15 years, I had a Marine haircut, mm-hmm. nothing on the top, flat on the top, mm-hmm. Nails cut short. And then all of a sudden my hair started growing, my nails started growing, I started losing weight. So to deal with a lot of the stress and to keep in shape, I ran a lot. Mm-hmm. So I was running an average of 5 miles a day. Mm-hmm. And so I was probably in the best shape of my life. I was, you know, tall and thin, but I'd gotten to the point where I was like really thin.
Yeah.
And people actually thought I was sick, because mm-hmm. I had lost probably another 20 pounds that I really didn't need to lose. Mm-hmm. And so she asked me, you know, do you have cancer? What's going on? I'm like, no, Mama, it's something else. No, Mama, it's something else. It's something else. Well, I just don't understand. I said, well, I'm transitioning. I'm going to become your daughter.
Mm.
What? She asked a few more questions and just sat there and said, okay, you can go home now. And I left. And about 2 hours later, I get a phone call from one of my sisters, just tearing me a new one.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were going to wait until Mom, and and she's here crying, and she doesn't know what to do, and it's all her fault, and you did all this wrong, and she doesn't want to see you.
Mm.
So don't call her. So for at least six weeks, I didn't talk to my mother, keeping in mind that I talked to my mother every day of my life up to that point.
Yeah.
And so it was excruciating.
Yeah.
And then one day I get a phone call from my sister Karen. She says, Mama wants to talk to you. So she gets on the phone and she's like, well, I love you. You're my child. You can come over again, but you'll never come over here like dressed like that. And I'll never call you anything but the name I gave you.
Mm.
And so went like that for several months.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dad's cancer reemerged.
Mm.
And he ended up in the hospital and then came home, and he had bone cancer, and it was like the last 6 weeks of his life.
Yeah.
And he fell one day and Mom couldn't help pick him up.
Mm.
And so we were in a little family meeting sitting at the table trying to decide, well, we don't want to put Dad into like a rehab center or something. We want to keep him at home. Mm-hmm. And hospice can offer us a lot. We're talking about this, and all of a sudden, Mother has a seizure right there in the dining room.
Yeah.
So we ended up calling 911. She goes to the, and she ended up having a kidney infection and stuff. So how it ended up, my sisters took care of Mama in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I would move into the house and take care of Dad. So I took care of Dad and had a lot of help from family doing that. And then Mama came home and I was taking care of her and Dad. And then I think she really saw me doing everything just the way she would do it.
Mm.
Because mm-hmm. she had taught me to be her daughter.
Yeah.
And then my hair was long, so I kept my hair back in a ponytail. Usually just wore, you know, jeans and a t-shirt all day. But she saw everything that I did. And she would sit at the table and I'd cook something and she's like, oh, you need to do this. You need to, well, Mama, we've cooked it the same way for 25 years. Well, you never do it quite right. and we would just sit there and argue and, you know, we'd make whatever we'd need to make. And then I think she realized that she raised a daughter. And then after Dad died, I ended up being able to afford to have my gender confirmation surgery in November of 2005. So I moved into the house with her for about 6 weeks, and then I went back to where I'd sold my house. I was living with one of my cousins, and I moved back to my place, but I kept going up every weekend. She's like, why don't you just move in?
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up, and so Mom and I have been living together since about 2006.
Wow.
You know, she treats me like a daughter. She buys me clothes. I make sure she's fed, and
yeah.
Now she's 86 and I do, you know, all the shopping and all the cooking mm-hmm. and all the cleaning. I have one of my nieces now comes over and help me clean, praise God. But we have grown closer and it definitely took time.
Mm-hmm.
It took time. I think the biggest fear was that I would be ostracized and not mm-hmm. have a life.
Yeah.
That I would end up alone.
Yeah.
And people would be mean to me mm-hmm. and I would never have any friends. But the way my life has turned out, I have more friends now than I've ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends across the country. I really blossomed and bloomed. I've been given a voice.
Yeah.
And the voice of, you know, the Holy Spirit speaks through me. And, you know, I really, at 61 years of age, I had no choice because of, you know, over 40 years of intensive indoctrination into the gender binary. I had no choice but to transition and become my mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's right for me. And what I really, really love is seeing young trans people who, you know, are in adolescence, 13, 14, 15 years old, who are able to express themselves as they truly are and not have that burden of that intensive socialization into the binary.
Yeah, I agree. So before we started the interview, I talked about how I have been thinking about these maybe larger topical issues that impact BIPOC women. And one of the issues that had come up for me was spirituality and how that is something that I think has a lot of, you know, I think even just through your story, there's so much cultural, historical weight that comes with spirituality in our communities. And I think that it's such an important topic because I think that it's, you know, for so many different reasons in terms of how we express it, what it means to us, and then just having the capacity to talk about it and how it impacts every part of our lives, right? Whether or not we are actively practicing or attending, you know, or part of a spiritual community. So I would love to learn more just in terms of how, I mean, it seems like obviously in terms of your whole journey, this has been the culmination of your calling. And how you're able to live that out in this stage of your life. But I'd be curious just for how you help people in your congregation, outside of your congregation, specifically people of color, start to think about their spirituality, the impact, their expression of it. I know that's a big question. But, you know, I think I would just love to hear more about how you talk about that piece of it.
First, I think it is so important for people to see themselves in the pulpit. Mm-hmm. And because so much of the time, the pulpit throughout history has been populated by men. And men who are in the positions of power. And in the United States, it's been white men. And you can go back in history. It's the dominant culture and class and the dominant males who are in the pulpits making the rules and determining who does and doesn't go to heaven. Mm-hmm. And so for me to be in a pulpit, a transgender Latina, a transgender woman of color, it's important for a lot of people that are all made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And that is so incredibly important to be a role model for so many people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try and nurture and help as many, you know, I just agreed, even though I don't have the time in my calendar, mm-hmm. I'm going to mentor another faith formation class out of Luther Seminary because it's important for these young people. I would say probably more likely than not out of what, maybe 8 or 10 of them that'll be in there, at least 8 of them, at least 90% of them will be white.
Right.
So it's important for them to see a person of color in a position of power, talking to them, and hopefully I can give to them some insight of why. If this were on being recorded video, you would see behind me my altar in my room, where I have a picture of, you know, I have what, 1, 2, 3 images of Guadalupe. And then I have a picture that a dear friend gave me of Frida Kahlo holding a picture of Guadalupe. Yeah. And then I have, you know, my rosary hanging from the wall and another cross. Guadalupe, you know, I've always heard not all Mexicanos are Catholic, but all Mexicanos are Guadalupanos.
You know? Yeah. Right, right.
And there's this fierce, fierce devotion. And I was born on December 12th, the feast day of La Virgen de Guadalupe. So I've always been a Guadalupana. Mm-hmm. And she is always, even in when I turn my back on God, I always had my rosary with me.
Yeah.
And I first learned to pray the rosary with my grandma Celia, you know, on the floor of her kitchen at 5 o'clock in the morning. Paco Sanchez on Cape Bueno would play the rosary at 5 a.m. every day, and she would be there on her knees. And on my wall is the rosary she gave me 60 years ago. that I prayed on for decades until I finally retired it because it's getting kind of delicate. So I have always have a rosary in my purse, and I will say the rosary at least once a week. Mama says a rosary every day. So that's, you know, and I've introduced that to my congregation right around December 12th, no matter what it, I have music and a sermon about Guadalupe. And I've preached in a lot of Lutheran churches about Guadalupe, what it means, and why I'm fiercely devoted to her image. So trying to bring a little, and you know, the whole Guadalupe mystique is so complex and so complicated. Oh my gosh. You know, there are volumes about, you know, is she really used, was she a tool of colonization? Was she a tool that, that she, and I truly believe she was the mother of God who came down to give comfort and console her people. But they are people who were forced to become her people at the point of a sword. It's so complicated, but I've always known she has guided me and protected me my whole life, fiercely devoted to her. In that, not like a traditional Catholic devotion where you say your rosary, you get 500 indulgences.
Right.
No. For me, Mary was at the, Mary said yes to the angel Gabriel when she should have said no. She put her life on the line by saying yes and being impregnated by the Holy Spirit at 14, 15 years old, being betrothed, not married. She should have been stoned. By the law, she should have been put to death. But she said yes. She, if you read the Gospel of John, she initiated the ministry of Jesus. It's at the wedding of Cana. They went to her and said, we're out of wine. And she went to Jesus and said, you know, they're out of wine. He says, what? What am I supposed to do about it? And she just smiles at him, nods at him, turns, do what he says. He's like, okay, Ma. It starts my favorite joke with Mary and Jesus is Jesus is there, you know, and the woman is at his feet and you with the first, you know, who has no sin cast the first stone. Rock goes flying by his head. He turns up and looks, Ma, I'm trying to work here.
That's a good joke.
And she's there at the foot of the cross. When they had all run being scared, fearing for their lives, she was at the foot of the cross. And that's where I want to be, unafraid, totally devoted to her son, because he was the Lord, the Messiah. And so that's really the focus and center of my ministry, is just letting people know that it doesn't matter who you are, what you've done. The grace of God knows no bounds. That you are, you have received, you have been given that gift of grace, and nobody is worthy of it. But God loves us anyway. We're all broken human beings. We all think of ourselves first so much of the time. We all look out for trying to get as much as we can so that when we die, we have the most toys. But if you really look at the world and what, you know, this country can produce, we really live in abundance. There is so much more than we will ever need. And we could feed the world. We could clothe the world. We could house the world. But Satan walks the world and whispers into people's ear, there's not going to be enough for you. You better try and get more. You better get more because there won't be enough for you.
Yeah. I mean, it seems as though, like, for you, it's this, obviously, this combination of how you're able to show up in the church in order to create more space for other people to see themselves there. And then also just your own spiritual practice and how you continue to cultivate that. And that's so, and I think that that's, you know, I think obviously for someone in ministry, a reverend, those things are important, but maybe not always present, right? Just because someone is in a position of leadership in the church doesn't mean that they're actively cultivating their own spiritual life and feel that type of devotion that you do. And it seems as though you're very, very intentional about how you show up in order to give people who are going to continue to be in leadership a different perspective about your own faith journey and then about your own identity.
Yeah, I hope that sums it up well. And, you know, and we just entered the period in the church called Lent.
Yeah.
And so this is a period of deep introspection.
Yeah.
And a lot of prayer. And I'm just starting, actually, tomorrow starts a new class that I'm going to take on the Franciscan Way. So I really, really love St. Francis, and I'm a postulant in the Order of Lutheran Franciscans. And what I love about Francis is the fact that he was actually a layperson. He never went to seminary. He never got the degree, but he was called by God. He left behind a life of luxury in the 1200s in order to follow Jesus. And his whole, he didn't center on orthodoxy. So orthodoxy are basically the beliefs that we have. Mm-hmm. And that's what we go to seminary to learn, orthodoxy. We learn how to read scripture. We learn how to look into all our different books. You know, in the ELCA, we have the Book of Concord, which is essentially all the combination of all the works of Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon and all those people in the 1500s that brought all their stuff together to justify why they had to break away from the Catholic Church. That's orthodoxy. But what Francis really centered on with was orthopraxis, the actual doing of your faith. We can all sit and we can all pray and be really good Orthodox Lutherans, but if we don't do something about it, then it's meaningless. Absolutely meaningless. So what we need to do, and one of the quotes that's attributed to Francis, which I absolutely love, is every day you have to proclaim the gospel. And if you have to, use words. It's how we actually do it. And, you know, it's been challenging this past year where we have a beautiful building. We have almost 5 acres and it's been sitting there and we've been, you know, opening it to small groups to do things, but not huge gatherings. I'm really hoping that everything works out, that we're going to host a YMCA youth camp this summer in our basement, and so we can have anywhere from 30 to 50 kids in the bottom floor of our church, Monday through Friday, 7 to 6, and the Y is going to bring in the people. And you know, I just want the building to be used. Hopefully, we can starting this fall, we can open it back up and start having weddings and baptisms and bar mitzvahs or whatever we want, because we have a beautiful fellowship hall for people to use. And I want that building to look run down and torn up, because we have 1,000 people in and out our front doors every week.
Yeah, I love that. So, Nicole, you know that this podcast is about Black, Indigenous, and women of color who are overcoming trauma and becoming resilient. So I would love to hear what resilience means to you.
No, I've realized I can't do any of this alone. And so, you know, my family, I always laughed. I never had friends growing up. I never needed friends. I had cousins. And, you know, people laugh at me because, you know, if I need something, my fence just flew down. Well, call my cousin Kevin. I'm going to take my car in. Well, my cousin Spencer is going to work on it. So for, you know, being a Latina, family comes first, and I've always had them around me, and they give me strength. You know, when I saw some negative stuff coming up on Facebook or whatever, my cousins would jump in and they would just, like, you know, peck at people. They have my back. Always have my back. So having my family and then having my community around me, we can't do any of this alone. You know, and I have friends throughout the country who I still correspond with as much as possible. And, you know, one of the greatest ventures or retreats I went on was specifically for trans people of color. And, you know, I can't remember the group. It's based out of Charlotte, North Carolina, of all places. One of the bishops out there who is a good friend has a really soft, and she's a woman of color. She has a a specific ministry just for trans people of color. And so I found it really, really helpful and useful to have strong relationships with other trans people of color in ministry. So, you know, Deborah and Michael just put out an article this week about Charlotte, and that's why it came to mind. One of my dear friends, Jamie Sprague Ballou, is a UCC pastor, and she's a transgender woman of color, a transgender Latina, who's a pastor in the UCC. And I love her. And she's, you know, is a driving force between LA, behind the Las Vegas trans activities. And so having that other layer of support. And then I found that I have a therapist. I have a spiritual director. I have a spare therapist because I still have shit to deal with all the time.
As we all do.
You know? So I need to have a therapist. I need to have a spiritual director because I, you know, I keep asking, why is God doing this to me? So I have to have somebody to talk to about, you know, my relationship with God. I have a life coach because this job is hard. Being a pastor and being a therapist, it's really freaking hard. So I have a life coach so that I can kind of separate, you know, move aside the minutiae and then actually set goals and be accountable to her. And I have a clergy group of people that I meet with once a month so that I can talk about what's it like being a pastor right now and everything that we're doing and complain about our congregations and lift up our congregations and, you know, just say, I absolutely love God and have a close relationship with God, but God's people are a pain in the butt, you know? So resilience comes from just having a really, really strong support network that I actually use. And on many levels, it's just not one or two, three people. I have 100 people in my support network. And at different times, I need to reach out to them and be there for them. So that way, I can be there for other people.
I love that. I think that's so important because, you know, I think we view counseling therapy as the helping profession. But you are in a, you are in two helping professions. And like you said, being a pastor is hard. Being a trans Latina pastor in a 96% white church is a significant challenge. And I think that you're absolutely right that we can, I think a huge challenge, I think even for women of color, this is actually probably the theme for the week. All the recordings that I'm doing, it keeps, this keeps coming up. It's probably a message I need to hear right now. And we can't do it alone, right? We need help. And asking for help is the thing that is going to not only sustain our work, but is going to sustain us. We have to be the number one. We have to be the priority.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I'm trying to take more time for self-care. It's hard, you know, I'm primary caregiver for my mother. So, and this week she just had some surgery. So I'm working from home all week. So I'm not quite sure when I'll be able to get a little bit of time off. But I keep that in mind that this spring I'm going to run off and do something. Get one of my sisters to come stay with mama and I'm just going to go hide for 3 days.
Good. You should absolutely do that. I'm in full support of that.
And I also have to remember, you know, where I come from. Somebody asked me one time, what's your favorite music? And I'm like, mariachi. That's almost all I listen to these days because it reminds me of where I come from and, you know, like Los Lobos, I love their Spanish. They put out, you know, like Sabor a Mi is my favorite song in the world. And they do a beautiful rendition of it. And then there was a novella on probably, I don't know, 13 or 14 called La Hija de la, del Mariachi with Carolina Ramos. And I love her, her renditions of everything. So I listen to her all the time on YouTube and their albums. And that kind of reminds me of where I come from. Cause I remember growing up, there was always, we always had dances and I had cousins who had a band. So we listened to the Vibratones or the Mood Express or always dancing and, you know, corridos and rancheras and valses and everything. That's where I come from. And that's what I remember. So I almost always have, mariachi or Corridos on my car radio because mm. that reminds me of who I am and where I come from.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Well, thank you so much for being a guest. I say this after every interview and I really, truly mean it. I feel like we could talk for hours and I need to have you back. So, because I feel like we got like, I just ran my finger across the top of your story.
But thank you. And thank you for letting me ramble on.
No, it was so great and so helpful and so informative. And I'm going to have everyone back. I know I say all the time, but I'm going to have every guest back and you all are going to hear more. So.
Yeah, and you have some great, great guests. Yeah. I've been listening to your podcast and I love them. So it's such an honor to be here with you.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you on, Nicole. It was an honor to have you. And I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Down for my soul, y'all. For your soul, yo. This ain't a theory, really. This ain't something that I made up or like to believe. It's not fucking selfish.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you or your company are looking to jump into the podcast world, now is the time. The Plug Agency is here to connect you to the full power of podcasting. You just record and leave the rest to us. The people are listening and want to hear from you. Theplug-agency.com. That's theplug-agency.com. Click the link in the episode description for an exclusive offer.